This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Those of us who are middle class know that living conditions are bad in America's inner city housing projects, but we may not realize how bad things have gotten. Alex Kotlowitz worries that many of us don't even care. In 1987, Kotlowitz wrote an award-winning series for the Wall Street Journal on the toll inner-city violence takes on the children who live there. He focuses on two of those children, Faro and Lafayette Rivers, in the new book, There Are No Children Here. Faro and Lafayette live in Chicago's Henry Horner housing project. It's only about a mile from Kotlowitz's downtown office, but it's a world away. In the summer of 1987, police estimated that an average of one person every 3 days was beaten, shot, or stabbed in the 8 blocks of these high-rise projects. There is no security. The hallways are dark, even in the daytime. Kotlowitz says that even though he knew conditions would be bad in the projects, he was still shocked by what he saw.
Yeah, I was very surprised. In fact, when I first met Lafayette, the older of the two boys that I write about, when I first met him, he told me about two incidents, one in which he watched a young boy die on the stairwell outside his apartment, and also about a 10-year-old girl who had been shot in the leg while jumping rope out the front of his building. And he told it in such a matter-of-fact way that I didn't quite believe it when he first told me about it. I didn't quite believe all this violence actually occurred. And it took me a while, going back time and time again, to realize that, in fact, these kids, if anything, were sort of understating what actually was taking place. I think conditions have gotten just so much worse in the past 15, 20 years in our inner cities.
Well, the mother in the family that you wrote about was so concerned she took out burial insurance on her children.
Right, which apparently is not unusual. There's such a concern that these children aren't going to make it to adulthood. Lafayette, for example, talks about when you ask him what he wants to be when he grows up, he doesn't say when I grow up, he says if I grow up. And there's a real sense of mortality in this community, a real sense that the death may just be right around the corner.
Why did you focus on the specific family that you did? Was there something about them that you felt summed up a way of life, or were they a particularly good family to use as a guide to let you know what was happening in the projects?
Well, I think particularly what attracted me to the family were the two boys, Faro and Lafayette, because when I first started writing the book, Faro was 9 and Lafayette were 12, and what struck me about them is here were two children from the same family who dealt with the traumas and the violence and the tragedies in their lives in very different ways. Lafayette, who keeps everything to himself and is a very sad, if not depressed, boy. And Faro, who's very spirited and loves school and clutches onto his childhood with incredible vigor. And so what attracted me to the family was the sort of dichotomy between these two children, which I thought was fairly representative of how kids in neighborhoods like these try to get by.
Well, also they had older brothers and sisters who had already run into pretty serious problems.
Right, and that was the other thing about the family that interested me and attracted me to using them, profiling them for a book like this was, yeah. In fact, one of the boys during the course of the book is sent to prison for armed robbery, and not uncommon for young black men to end up in prison. And the other thing is there's a long history of drugs in the family. The older sister who has been battling a drug habit for a number of years now, and also the father, who for almost 2 decades, off and on, has been battling drugs and primarily heroin and liquor. And that interested me. And the mother also, there's a certain attraction about the mother because she, on the one hand, is a very strong woman. She has absolutely nothing to do with drugs or drink and really cares so much about her children and has invested so much of herself in her kids and sees, in a sense, her way out of that life is for her kids to make it. And yet she's been so disappointed along the way, as so many mothers has. And there's a part of her that I can see beginning to give up. There's a certain passivity about her beneath all that strength, a certain sense of fatality about bringing up children in a neighborhood like this. And of course, she was the one who came up with the title of the book when I asked her whether she thought it a good idea for me to write a book about her children and their friend. She said to me, she said, "Alex, that sounds like a wonderful idea, but you know, there are no children here. They've seen too much to be children."
If you're just joining us, my guest is journalist Alex Kotlowitz, and his new book is called There Are No Children Here. And it's focusing on children that he spent a lot of time with, and as a matter of fact, still does spend a lot of time with, who live in the Henry Horner housing projects in Chicago. Let's get back to the two kids who you really focus on in your book, Lafayette and Pharaoh. Are there ways in which children of their age, which they in particular, are preyed on by the drug lords, by the gangs in the neighborhood?
You know, one of the things that I found curious when I went out there, and sort of one of the number of myths that for me was in a sense popped, was the idea that these young children, 10, 11, 12 years old, are wrapped up in the gangs and wrapped up in drugs. And in fact, what I found were children very much trying to be children. And in that, and having watched all that had gone on with their older siblings, older brothers and sisters and older friends, that they talk about drugs disparagingly. They can't at that age imagine touching drugs or being involved with the gangs. And in fact, there's a gang leader in my book who doesn't want children, young children, running drugs for him. But once they turn 14, 15, 16 years old, the currents become so strong that these kids just find it so hard to swim against it.
What kind of currents are you talking about? What specifically?
The gangs, for one. The drug gangs out there is certainly the primary source of employment for a lot of these children, and for some of them, the primary source of family. And a lot of these children will become very wrapped up in the gangs, which now in Chicago and other cities, our primary reason for being is to sell drugs. And so often the kids will get wrapped up in the gangs. There are kids who, when they turn 15, 16, 17 years old, will also begin to take drugs themselves or begin to drink, and also begin to commit crimes. One of the things that struck me is there's just an incredible amount of anger in these children. And you can see how it begins to find its way to the surface as they get older.
While you were working on this book, Lafayette, the older brother, started getting involved with a little bit of shoplifting.
Mm-hmm.
Were you able to see a sense of change in him as he started doing that?
Yeah, you know, I did. Lafayette, who is, as I mentioned earlier, somebody, a boy who keeps so much to himself and has so much trouble just opening up. In fact, during the course of the book and having gone to two funerals, I never saw him cry once. And I did begin to see changes in him. He got involved in a shoplifting incident, and later on in the book, too, he also got involved in allegedly breaking into a car by the stadium. And one of the things that he said to me I thought was very telling. After I had finished the book, he said to me, "Alex, I'm worried that I'm going to end up like my older brothers and sisters." And there was a sense that his destiny and fate was out of his hands, that he just simply did not have much control over what was going to happen to him. And there is that sense of hopelessness, particularly as the kids get older.
You became so close to the kids you were writing about. Did you try to change their behavior in any way, or direct them in any way?
Yeah, it was when I started off writing the book, I think I went in there with a sense that I could sort of keep some distance and write about these children and sort of stay in the background. And I guess ultimately I found that impossible and became very good friends with both the boys. And there were times that we would sit down and just talk, and particularly after that shoplifting incident, for example, and Lafayette and I had a long talk about what that meant. I mean, it's a community that sort of doesn't allow for adolescent mistakes, and I don't know. I'm sure that my effect on the kids was in a sense twofold: one good, and perhaps one not so good. On the one hand, I'm sure I offered some positive influence, somebody they could talk to, certainly about all that was going on. On the other hand, because we spent a lot of time outside the community and saw other places, we go on a annual fishing trip, that I'm sure there's some bitterness amongst them that they haven't expressed to me, because now they have a strong sense about what could be, about how things could be different.
You've talked about how often children get caught in the crossfire, in gunfights, in the housing projects. Did you ever witness any of the gunfights that you described?
There were times that I was caught down in the crossfire when I had to take cover on the floor. And there were often times when you would hear the gunshots. I can remember one time being out on the playground with the kids, and there were sounds of gunfire, and the kids who were so quick to react ran into that building and left me on the playground by myself, and I just had to take off after them. It's part of a daily life in neighborhoods like this.
Alex, let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. And my guest is journalist Alex Kotlowitz, and he's written a new book called There Are No Children Here. And it's about years of research that he did in a housing project in Chicago. And the book focuses on two boys growing up in that project. We'll take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Journalist Alex Kotlowitz is my guest, and his new book, There Are No Children Here, grew out of a series of articles he wrote for the Wall Street Journal. He spent a lot of time talking to Pharaoh and Lafayette's mother. What are some of the things that she feels she's up against trying to bring children up in the kind of environment that they live?
Well, as I said earlier, there is a sense that things are out of her hands, that in some ways there's a sense that whatever she does, however hard she tries, there are still things beyond her control. And in fact, she's absolutely right. I mean, there's only so much you can do, you can only be so vigilant about watching after your children. And she worries one, I mean, her biggest worry is that her children will get caught in crossfire, as so often happens at Henry Horner. I mean, she worries about her children dying. As you point out earlier, here she is taking out burial insurance on her children who have not even reached adolescence.
One of her sons, Terrence, was a father by the time he was 14. By 18, he'd been arrested 46 times. Does she blame herself for that, or does she just blame the conditions in the project and in the neighborhood?
I think that for her, you know, she would alternate. There would be times that she would blame the neighborhood and blame how the conditions, how worse things had gotten, how much harder it was to grow up there. And at other times, she would be more reflective and think that if only she had done things differently. One of the things that struck me in being out in that community for all these years is that being in such an oppressive environment, that the human frailties quickly rise to the surface. And I think with somebody like LeJo, she sensed that too with herself, that there were things about her that would sort of become much stronger character traits than they otherwise might have. And I think she worried that at times she wasn't strong enough with her, forceful enough with her children, that she was too passive, that she worried early on that maybe she had paid too much attention to Terrence, that she had spoiled him in a sense. At one point she even confided that she had promised him that she wasn't going to have any more children. And of course she proceeded to have five more kids. So yeah, there is a lot of self-blame, and you begin to lose some sense of self-respect for yourself. I mean, I think it's the ultimate tragedy in communities like this that the adults who do care and who do feel a sense of strength and begin to lose their children, begin to lose some sense of self-respect because they take some of the responsibility for what happened.
Where did the Rivers family get their income, and how much money a month would they live on?
The mother is on public aid, and she has been for about 8 years. And she receives, I think, roughly $540, $550 in cash each month. And in addition to that, she receives about $300 or $400 in food stamps. And this is for her and her five children, Lafayette and Pharaoh. And then there are a set of triplets who are now 8 years old. In addition to that, she has other people living in her apartment. She also has her older daughter and her older daughter's boyfriend, and they have three children. And LeJo's brother often spends time over there. Now, her daughter also receives some public aid, so that money doesn't have to feed all of them. But as is typical in most families that receive public aid, by the end of the month, by the third or fourth week, she begins to run out of food stamps and runs out of food. And the children really have to cut back on their meals, and there are occasions when they are at times hungry.
You had written a story about this family previously for the Wall Street Journal, and you suspect that as a result of the story, the Rivers family ended up with less money in their federal benefits.
Right. I don't suspect. I know. In fact, after my story came out, the public aid department launched a large investigation about Legault's eligibility for public aid. And the reason for that, there was one line in my story in which I mentioned that her husband, Paul, who at the time was a bus driver for the city, sporadically lived at home. And in fact, he sporadically came home. Most of his money, however, went to drugs and alcohol. And public aid had seen that one line, the Department of Public Aid had seen the one line in my article, and subsequently launched this massive, humiliating investigation of Legault and indeed cut her off from public aid. The public aid department conceded to me that, in fact, they spend a lot of their time looking through newspapers to find possible so-called cheats, people who might be ineligible on welfare. I think for me, that was so symbolic of what this nation has gone through over the past 10 or 15 years, where we're here, an agency, the Department of Public Aid, which provides money for mothers and their children, rather than trying to assist these families, is actually spending time going out and trying to figure out ways to cut off benefits. And it is a mindset that I think this nation has got to get out of, in which we really begin to need to look and how we can assist families like the Rivers, and not ways to make life more difficult for them.
You didn't maintain the typical journalist's distance from your subjects. You used the money from an award that you got to bail out one of the brothers in the family that you're writing about. You've used money that you've gotten from your book to send the two boys who you focus on to private school. Mm-hmm. What went behind your thinking when you decided to use your own money to directly improve their lives?
I think ultimately spending all that time with Lafayette and Farah, it was hard, first of all, not to become very close to them. And it was a friendship, I think, that probably has, at least I know, has enriched my life a lot. And spending so much time with them, I felt an obligation as a friend to do what I could to help them. And indeed, I did send the two boys to private school. Lafayette is now back in public school. It was too tough for him academically. And I did that after I finished reporting the book, not because I sort of held back the money, but frankly, I didn't have the money until I completed the book. But I think without meaning to sound falsely modest, I can't imagine that anybody might have embarked on an endeavor like this and not have become very close with these children. I mean, I constantly had to remind myself through the course of this book that these are just children. They're just kids. And I was very sensitive to that. There were often times when I would ask them, I was very careful to tell them everything that was going into the book. And there were some small things that they asked me not to put in the book, mostly things that might embarrass them, kids' things. And I was very sensitive to that. And it was also my reason ultimately for focusing on the children, is because whatever you can say about the adults, the children are innocent. They're innocent of what is and of what could be. And you're absolutely right. We did become very good friends over the course of the book, and there may be those who say I wasn't objective, but it's hard to watch children growing up in an environment like that and not to pull it and tug at your heart.
What are Farrow and Lafayette doing now?
Farrow's he's in seventh grade at Providence St. Mel, an all-black private school on the west side, and it's been hasn't been without a struggle for him, but he's one determined kid, and he wants to go on to college, and I think that if he keeps at it, that it's not unlikely for him. Lafayette is back in public school. Lafayette's not as academically inclined as Farrow, he's managed to stay away from the gangs, and he's managed to stay out of trouble with the law, but as I mentioned earlier, he did just a few months ago said to me he worries that he's going to be like his older brothers and sisters and like his older friends. And there is a sense that things are a little bit out of his control. And he's also a boy who cares so much about everybody else that sometimes he doesn't spend enough time worrying about himself.
So you've done things to directly help the two boys you've written about. Have you had to confront the difficult situation of drawing the line when asked for something?
I pause because it has been an issue, and the issue of where to set limits. I think from my friendship with Lafayette and Farrell, there probably are no limits in what I'm willing to do, given my capabilities. I think with other family members and other people out there have been limits set, and it's been very difficult setting those limits. Because people know, and that first of all, that if people need loans, for example, often people will come to me and ask if they can borrow money. And I understand that they have no other source of borrowing, nobody else to borrow money from other than the drug dealers. And it has been very tough setting the limits. But I think with Pharaoh and Lafayette, with the two boys, that we have a very close friendship. And I think that the limits in our friendship are the limits of any friendship, which I think are infinite.
So what do you tell the people who you have to say no to?
It's hard, Terry. It's hard. And often I find I can't say no. So it's
well. Do they play on your like whiteness and middle classness?
I think that in fact, I think the people who might ask me are people I've become friends with over the years,
mm-hmm.
And I think they ask me as a friend. And there have been people who have finally just said no to. There have been people who I've known there for many years who might have asked to borrow $50 or $75, and I know will pay me back. And there are people who may ask to borrow that money and I know won't pay me back. And so that plays into it. I mean, there is a sense from my part that, you know, that as much as we as a nation, I don't mean to sort of disengage myself from this, but that we've neglected these neighborhoods, but also that people in these neighborhoods have neglected themselves. And ultimately, my feeling was that if people respected me, I would respect them. And if people wanted to borrow $50 and paid me back, then I would be willing to lend them money again. And if they didn't, I just said no.
Well, Alex, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you, Terry.
My guest has been Alex Kotlowitz, and he's the author of the new book, There Are No Children Here, the story of two boys growing up in the other America. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.